Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. There's a mole in the ground, and I root it down. And I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish that you're not a sunglasses. Oh, I wish that you're not a sunglasses. If I is not a sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the OMO Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. Today is Veterans Day, and today's program will focus on veterans' affairs. And we'll be playing a couple of anti-war songs that focus on veterans as well. Jan Hocken and Fran Michelle will be talking about health care in the VA. In the same piece, Denise Morris discusses with Jan her film Mind Zone, Therapist Behind the Front Lines. I'll be doing a reading entitled How Veterans Changed the Military and Rebuilt the Middle Class by Kevin Basil. Larry Bolden, our book critic, reviews two books today. Despite his prejudice against super popular novelists, he's going to review first The Dutch House by Ann Patchett and then The World That We Knew by Alice Hoffman. Leading off today's program, Bill Resnick interviews Garrett Reppenhagen, National Director of Veterans for Peace. The interview is about Veterans for Peace, its radicalism, its people, its democratic organization, and mostly about the duty of all servicemen and women to refuse to obey illegal orders and how that operated sometimes in the past and its importance today. Garrett Reppenhagen will be speaking tomorrow in an Armistice Day, also known as Veterans Day, rally at 11 a.m. at Directors Park at 815 Southwest Park Avenue, sponsored by the Portland VFP. His talk, To Proclaim an End to all Wars. Bill?
Hi, Garrett Reppenhagen. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Garrett Reppenhagen is the Executive Director of Veterans for Peace. Tomorrow is Veterans Day. Veterans for Peace refers to it as Armistice Day. When this interview will be aired, we're pre-recording. Tomorrow, Garrett will not only be on the air here, he'll be speaking in a rally in Portland at 11 in Directors Park, which is on 815 Southwest Park Avenue. The leaflet says, Join Portland, Oregon Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 to proclaim an end to all wars. Veterans for Peace is a wonderful organization, and the rally will be a great opportunity to meet Garrett and his Portland comrades at 11 tomorrow at Directors Park. So, Garrett, I went to the Veterans for Peace website. As we used to say, I was really blown away by its sweeping concerns, its purposes, and the intelligent radicalism of its materials and analyses. And reading the material, I found two issues to be really important that I would like to talk about today. The first is the military and its commitment to refuse to obey illegal orders. The second has to do with Veterans for Peace, which is, in distinction to the military hierarchy, it insists its chapters and the organization as a whole operate democratically. First, though, tell us about why Veterans for Peace, its mission, and then your history, how you came to Veterans for Peace.
Yeah, well, it's an incredible organization. You got military veterans, and I don't know anybody else who's more credible to talk about war and challenge our foreign policy. People who've actually served in combat overseas and in missions guided by the United States and coming to an awakening through that experience or transformation through that experience to actually want to make sure that there's justice in the world, that we're using the military responsibly or not using it at all. And I think it's a powerful voice to have veterans talk about that. So I was a sniper in Iraq. I was a U.S. Army 1st Infantry Division soldier. I joined as a cavalry scout 1 month before September 11th. And it's through that experience of being a sniper, participating in the brutality of war, being a perpetrator of violence for this nation and for our corporations, and realizing that things had to change. And I didn't want another soldier to go through what I did and kill so many people who are undeserving of that for really money interests and political goals of individuals in this country.
You came from a military family, I read.
Yeah, both my grandfathers served in World War II. My father served in Vietnam. He died of Agent Orange-related cancer when I was 13 years old.
Oh, really?
Like many of the people in his platoon that also died, he was an engineer in Vietnam digging in the soil that was contaminated with Agent Orange. And he retired Army the year he retired. He died of Agent Orange-related cancer. So I was familiar with the military. I grew up on military bases. I was born in Fort Bliss Army Hospital in El Paso, Texas. So I was quite familiar with the military, or at least I thought I was growing up. And my father never really talked about his war experiences. I had to eavesdrop on backyard barbecue conversations with his war buddies to get a glimpse of what that was. But having a father who served in Vietnam, like most people, I learned about the war through, movies like Platoon and, fighting with plastic army men when I had a direct source living with me in the same house. But, he certainly had post-traumatic stress disorder, and I didn't realize that until I had post-traumatic stress disorder coming back from war in Iraq. So, yeah, I'm from a military family, and it wasn't really the tradition that drove me to join. When my dad passed away, I was a high school dropout, working three, four jobs sometimes, sleeping in my car in the parking lot waiting for the next job. And I finally kind of realized that I should probably go to college, and I couldn't afford it, so I joined up. It was an economic draft, if you will, for me.
This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, the old Mole Variety Hour. KABU's non-commercial, independent, aspires to democratic functioning, often meets that standards. It's Bill Resnick talking to Garrett Reppenhagen, the executive director. It's a participatory leadership of the organization's Veterans for Peace. Garrett, there's one issue that I'd really like to talk about in depth. It's the extent of the Army's commitment to refuse to disobey illegal orders. We can talk about that. That's going to become increasingly important, I think, in the future. So, Garrett, tell us about the refusal to disobey, its origins, maybe its history.
Yeah, I think every service member has the right to disobey an unlawful order. But, there's a blurry line on what you determine is an unlawful order. I think that, there's no lower enlisted soldier in the military that is a constitutional lawyer and understands, the intricacies of that sort of level of issues. But we all have a moral compass and individual values. We know what's right and wrong. And, a lot of times our activity in war blurs those lines as well. And I don't think that we'd have 22 veterans a day killing themselves if they came back from the war and thought they were doing the right thing. So, the failure to disobey unlawful orders, I think, is a difficult thing to handle for a lot of service members. You've got Lieutenant Erwin Tata years ago that said that deployment to Iraq was an unlawful order and challenged that. And I believe he ultimately, won that case. So,
is that right?
Yeah, I think he did, or at least came to some sort of deal with the U.S. military about it. So he wasn't forced to deploy to Iraq. So it's a difficult one. When you look at, we were talking earlier about what side would a military service member ultimately lie on if there was a split, if the President of the United States decided to go one way against the will of most of the public. You do make an oath when you enlist in the military to follow the commander in chief, and he's your boss. So I don't think that'll ultimately hold if the president goes in a direction that really is against most people's values. I think a lot of people will either desert the military, fight against their own forces, or join state forces like the National Guard or militias that are trying to do something different than what the federal government is doing. So I believe that you would have a lot of controversy there. And of course, the state of the nation, who knows what it will be like at that point. But there could be other factors, such as getting paid. If there's no tax money going to the federal government and the federal government is ceasing to operate, then I think you'll see a lot of soldiers standing down because they're just not, you know, they're not, the logistical situation is starting to break down, and they'd rather probably be home taking care of their families and in their communities rather than fighting for the military. Yeah. But
on the Veterans for Peace website, there was a call to all military members to refuse to take part in an invasion of Venezuela when Trump was sort of hinting that that's what he was going to do with his big stick. He eventually, I suspect, because the army said, don't even think about it. There's a lot of intelligent people at the top of the armed forces now who disagree a lot with American foreign policy. But tell us about, what was his name, Condon?
Jerry Condon is our current president, board chair.
Yeah, and, he wrote a piece. How was it received?
You know, we have a deep and almost secret history of GI resistance in this country about active duty military actually denying orders and going against them. So there's a lot of great books and documentaries about it, but it's not something that's taught in our schools. And when the U.S. military, the actual service members, decide to stop fighting, then you could actually cease and stop war. So I think we, as military veterans, are able to appeal to current service members in a way that the general public can't. And I think it was received well. You know, I think we saw a lot of higher up level military brass taking note. And, you know, I think there's an extent where soldiers are trying to serve the people of the United States, and that's what gives us pride, and that's ultimately what that service is about. It's not service to the president that makes us feel, you know, feel that pride. It's trying to serve the public and doing right by them. So
yeah, in the Vietnam period, we surely saw that there really wasn't a rebellion in the ranks, and there was an organization that was, in fact, even at the army bases and doing organizing at the bases. Is Veterans for Peace able now, in its many chapters, to talk to soldiers about their duties and critique American foreign policy, as well as promote that commitment to, in fact, protecting and defending human rights? How do you get to soldiers now to build those ideas?
Yeah, I think it's a little different. You know, back in the day, we had GI coffee houses outside military bases all over the country. And I think, you know, right now, not having the large-scale conventional wars that we're used to protesting, like the Vietnam-style wars, and even the height of the Iraq War, the conflicts have changed. And also the way you reach out to people is different. I think a lot of service members are picking up stuff in the news and social media these days rather than having those direct conversations. So, you know, the great thing about, you know, our current media state and, you know, the internet is that we're able to reach people right there in their own barracks while they're on their computer or on their smartphones. So I think people are getting that information in those ways rather than in the physical direct conversations outside military bases.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Garrett Reppenhagen, who's the executive director of Veterans for Peace. We've been discussing his history and the history of lots of veterans, some in the organizations, many not, who see war as a racket. In the words of one old Smedley Butler, who became a dissident, unfortunately, after he... fortunately, he became a dissident, but unfortunately, he was a loyal soldier making Latin America safe for the American banks, as he put it later. There are lots of veterans with those understandings now. Veterans for Peace is not a huge organization, but you have a lot of chapters. There's a lot of work going on. I think part of your strength is the democratic commitments that Veterans for Peace has and discusses on its website. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Veterans for Peace, we have about 120 chapters internationally. We're all over the world, actually, not just in the United States. And I think anybody who's been a combatant and wants to put down his rifle and join organizing for peace is an incredible thing. And we are a very democratic organization. I think the philosophy of trying to get as much buy-in and decision-making power so there's less hierarchical decision-making, I think, is really important. We elect our board of directors from the membership, unlike a lot of nonprofit organizations that are kind of handpicked their board, and they rotate. They have times of service on the board of directors, and they're just elected by the membership. So I think it's a kind of a powerful way to do our leadership, unlike a lot of other nonprofit organizations. So there's new ideas, new input, and fresh faces all the time that we develop leaders that way. And it's a really amazing organization. It's really grassroots in that manner. So I think we're proud of that.
Yeah, I remember that old, during the days of the Wobblies, sometimes the police would make mass arrests of demonstrators and put them away for a while and then release them or whatever, sometimes shoot them. But they would always say, "Where are your leaders? We want to talk to your leaders," the police would say. And says, "We're all leaders," was the reply.
Yeah, our chapters operate very autonomously. They have a lot of authority within them, and it's one of the strengths, I think, of Veterans for Peace is we have a strong ground game, and the numbers that we count as far as our membership are only current due-paying members. So there's a lot of Veterans for Peace members who were members at one time, stopped paying their dues, but they still identify as Veterans for Peace members. We just don't count them exactly on our rolls, but I think a lot of them are still out there doing good work and still wearing the T-shirt. So it's a cool thing.
I think T-shirts are important. It's like lawn signs during an election. Mm. You know, you're personally saying to people who look at it, "Here are my values. Here's what I support." It's really a nice T-shirt too. You're wearing it now.
Oh yeah, I've got I've got our Black Lives Matters T-shirt, which is a strong campaign for the culture of peace. And you know, we have a peace at home, peace abroad philosophy, and we think that any efforts and any achievements we make towards the goals of peace isn't sustainable unless we all make it together as one. And we certainly don't want to see violence on our own streets here in America. I didn't fight overseas to come back to live in a war zone where cops are killing our own citizens. So we value that as well.
It's a wonderful organization. Do you accept memberships from people whose military experience was confined to the Boy Scouts, like
we allow a certain percentage of our organization to be associate members, and I don't think we're at anywhere near that cap. So anybody who wants to join and help us organize is welcome to do it. I don't think we could have had the achievements we've had without having our strong non-veteran allies at our side and helping us lead the way. So
yeah, I noticed that on your website you refer people to the National Lawyers Guild. Radical lawyers who, especially for veterans or service members who do in fact want to decide that they have to refuse an order that they consider immoral and illegal, the National Lawyers Guild is cooperating with you to defend those people, is my sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of tools. You know, there's a kind of a community-based GI rights hotline that soldiers can call and try to get advice, or at least get a voice on the other end of the line, a listening ear, to help kind of troubleshoot some issues. And if they get into serious problem, the National Lawyers Guild, and we have a handful of lawyers that are allied to us that are contacted on a regular basis. Organizations like Courage to Resist has a lot of good connections to some legal help. So we use all those assets, and I think we have a strong coalition of peace partners that are working with us to do that.
You can meet Garrett Rappenhagen tomorrow, 11 o'clock, Director's Park, on 815 Southwest Park. It's in that downtown, of course. Garrett Rappenhagen, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Tom Brown went off to war to fight on a foreign shore. His mama sure was proud of him. He stood so straight and tall in his uniform and all. His mama's face broke out into a grin. "Oh, son, you look so fine. I'm glad you're a son of mine. Make me proud to know you weren't a gun. Do what the captain says. Light the medals you will get. We'll put them on the wall when you get home." That old train pulled out. John's mom began to shout, telling everybody in the neighborhood, "Let's My son is about to go. He's a soldier now, you know. She made well sure her neighbors understood. She got a letter once in a while. Her face broke into a smile. She showed him to the people from next door. He bragged about her son with his uniform and gun in this thing she called a good old-fashioned war. Then the letter ceased to come. For a long time they did not come. Ceased to come for about 10 months or more. And when the letter finally came, saying go down and meet the train. Your son is coming back from the war. She smiled and she went right down. She looked up and all around. She did not see her soldier son inside. When all the people passed, she saw her son at last. When she did, she could not believe her eyes. Oh, his face was all shot off, and his hands were blown away. And he wore a metal brace around his waist. He whispered kind of slow, in a voice she didn't know. And she couldn't even recognize his face. Is it that you come to be this way? He tried his best to talk, but his mouth could hardly move, and his mother had to turn her face away. Don't you remember, Mom? When I went off to war, you thought it was the best thing I could do. I was on the battleground, you were home acting proud, you weren't there standing in my shoes. Well, I thought when I was there, Lord, what am I doing here? Trying to kill somebody or die trying. But the thing that scared me most, when my enemy came close, I could see that his face looked just like mine. And I couldn't help but think, through the thunder roll and stink, I was just a puppet in a play. And through the roaring smoke, the string had finally broke, and a cannonball blew my eyes away. That helped him stand. But as he turned to leave, he called his mother close, and he dropped his medals down into her hand.
Correction to announce, Garrett Reppenhagen will be speaking today, not tomorrow, in the Armistice Day Rally. That's at 11 a.m. at Director's Park at 815 Southwest Park Avenue. And this is KBOO Portland, or KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Old Mo Variety Hour. The song was Bob Dylan's John Brown, the terrific tale of one veteran's World War II experiences. The article I'm sharing with you today is also about veterans. It's an interesting history of veterans' struggles and protests against the government and the brass, and is entitled How Veterans Changed the Military and Rebuilt the Middle Class by Kevin Basil. We thank labor unions for the 8-hour workday, pensions, the weekend, and many other employment benefits Americans enjoy. Organized workers staged direct actions, strikes, sit-ins, boycotts, etc., forcing bosses to the bargaining table is a history that most of us learned in high school. More overlooked is the history of how modern military was shaped by veteran-led direct actions. For one thing, our military is famously all volunteers. Civilians no longer fear being drafted. To get those volunteers, recruiters and guidance counselors tout the free college education, sign-on bonuses, food and housing allowances, and BA benefits that come with military service. I was continually reminded of these things when I joined the Army in 2003. Look into the history of these developments and you'll find sit-ins, marches, and many other forms of direct action. GI Bill, passed in 1944, helped build the American middle class. It guaranteed millions of vets a college education, home loans, and more after World War II. It still does today. Veterans of World War I, however, received no such benefits. So throughout the 1920s and early 30s, they marched and demonstrated, demanding back pay compensation, referred to as a bonus, to reasonably match what their civilian counterparts had earned on the home front. The largest demonstration happened in 1932 with a 250,000-strong bonus army occupied Washington, D.C. for 2 months. The veterans vowed not to leave until Congress approved the bonus. Instead, General Douglas MacArthur removed them by force using U.S. cavalry troops and tear gas. But the veterans' efforts eventually paid off. The bonus was paid in 1936. This incredible history is documented in The Bonus Army by Paul Dickinson and Thomas B. Allen, and The War Against the Vets by Jerome Tussle. These years of protest by World War I veterans gave veterans organizations like the American Legion significant leverage in advocating for the GI Bill. President Roosevelt and Congress understood that not passing such a bill could mean veteran-led civil unrest or worse. Michael J. Bennett, historian of the GI Bill, writes, "After World War I, virtually every fighting nation other than Britain and the United States had their government overthrown by their veterans." End quote. It's no stretch to say the GI Bill was passed in part to prevent revolution. 2 decades later, in the 1960s, a movement when the U.S. armed forces emerged in opposition to the Vietnam War. Soldiers refused orders, sabotaged equipment, and spoke out at protests. In Soldiers in Revolt, GI Resistance During the Vietnam War, David Cotwright concludes that Nixon ended the draft in 1973 in response to this alarming resistance. The internal problems that gave rise to challenges in tactical employment to Vietnam, he wrote, were also responsible for the shift to an all-volunteer force. Of course, an all-volunteer force would need to offer better incentives to recruit people. This is where the improved living conditions, sign-on bonuses, and increased starting wages mentioned in every recruiter's sales pitch came from. In the 1970s, 80s, and beyond, the organization Vietnam Veterans Against the War made it a part of their mission to improve VA health care. They occupied VA offices, demonstrated, and even locked themselves inside the Statue of Liberty to amplify their message. They were key in getting the VA to recognize PTSD, Agent Orange exposure, and other illnesses affecting veterans. But as benefits were won, they can also be lost. Today, as more service members and veterans qualify for food stamps, the VA system remains on the verge of getting dismantled. Meanwhile, soldiers are receiving orders sending them into morally and legally questionable territory, such as Trump's Operation Faithful Patriot, deploying thousands of troops to the border of Mexico to stop unarmed immigrants. Against this history of veteran-led activism can provide inspiration and guidance. Direct action gets results. The article is How Veterans Changed the Military and Rebuilt the Middle Class by Kevin Basil. Basil is a freelance lawyer and musician. Now, coming up, Larry Bolden is going to be reviewing two books today. First, The Dutch House by Ann Patchett, and then The World That We Knew by Alice Hoffman. Larry?
Good morning. For almost all of my reading life, I've tended to prejudge pop novels and pop novelists. Certainly that prejudice has saved me from reading many bad or so-so novels, but it has also led me to miss some real gems. Today I'm going to say a few words about two 2019 novels. Although I don't intend to reveal much of the storylines, I want at least to recommend these books. The first has been on the bestseller list for quite a long time. It is a novel about a house, the Dutch House, and the family who lived there in a period spanning 5 decades. I've shortchanged Patchett before. It took me several years to get around to reading and reviewing her fine novel, Bel Canto, and almost as long to read The Magician's Assistant. But beginning now to talk about The Dutch House. A man who has been poor all of his life suddenly comes into a lot of money, and one of his first things to do is to buy a house he thinks to be the grandest he's ever seen. He buys it for his beloved wife, but she's uncomfortable in the house from the beginning and comes soon to hate it. Time and time again, she leaves the house and her two children, Danny and Maeve, and stays away for greater and greater lengths until finally she leaves for good. The two children are inseparable, only comfortable in the world when they are together. Maeve attempts to be the lost parent for her younger brother after they're forced out of the home when their father dies and leaves his entire estate to his second wife. The characters of the two children are very well fleshed out by Patchett, although their father, Cyril Conroy, is more a shadow than a fully developed character. The one provision Cyril had included in his will for his son Danny was a fund to pay for his education, including any graduate program he enters. Clever Maeve devises a plan to keep her brother in school for many, many years until he receives a medical degree, thus keeping at least some of their father's money from the merciless stepmother. I did not find this novel to be particularly important as a socio-political statement, but since the time spans include the Vietnam War and the political turmoil in this country right up to the present, Patchett does provide some insights into the separation of rich and poor and running commentary on political events. Still, the most important relationship described is that between the sister and brother. The scenes between them are touching and very believable and explore what I would call a kind of emotional incest. The second book, Alice Hoffman's The World That We Knew, is a wonderfully researched book about World War II and the Holocaust. I've been somewhat put off by Hoffman's inclusion of magic in her early, hugely popular novels like Practical Magic and The Rules of Magic. And magic enters this novel as well, but in a way I found much less intrusive. Quoting from the book, "In The World That We Knew, Hanny Kahn saw what was before her. She would do whatever she must to save those she loved, whether it was right or wrong, permitted or forbidden." Close quote. Honey's doctor husband has already been murdered in a riot outside his Jewish hospital when the reader is introduced to the surviving members of the family. Hanny knows she must do something to protect her beautiful 12-year-old daughter from the Nazi regime, but how can she protect her? While Hani is able to prevent a sexual assault on her daughter by a Nazi soldier, she does so only by killing the assailant and knows that the consequences will be dire. In a desperate move, Hani takes her daughter, Leah, to a renowned rabbi, pleading with him to help hide her daughter and to get her out of Germany. But it is the rabbi's daughter, Eddie, who steps in to save Leah, and she does so by creating a golem. Quoting from the book, "A golem may look human, but it has no soul. It is pure and elemental, and it has a single goal, to protect." Close quote. Eddie explains that the incantations must be exactly right, and if she makes a mistake, it will mean instant death to her. She finally agrees to create the golem in spite of the great risk, but only if Leah buys identification papers and a train ticket for Eddie's little sister so that she too can escape from Berlin. The rest of the novel describes the journey of Leah and Ava, the golem, as they escape to France and then through a long series of events that will get them to a place where they can join the French resistance and fight the Nazi occupation. It is very clear that this book was a labor of love for Alice Hoffman, and in my estimation, the most serious of her many successful novels. The bibliography at the back of the book evidences just how thorough Hoffman's research was in creating this novel. Leah and Eddie's life paths are entwined from the moment Eddie creates Ava and begins the long journey towards the south of France. There are so many wonderful and believable characters created by Hoffman as Leah and Ava continue their escape and find ways to enter into the fray and to help other Jews to escape Nazi rule. So, two hugely popular novels that deserve to be read. I've been talking about Anne Patchett's The Dutch House and Alice Hoffman's The World That We Knew. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And now every April I sit on my porch and I watch the parade pass before me. I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, reliving my dreams of past glory. My city, old man, all twisted and torn. The forgotten heroes of a forgotten war. And the young people ask me, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. And the band plays Waltz, Sing Matilda. And the old man still answers the call. But year after year, their numbers get fewer. Someday no one will march there at all. Waltz, Sing Matilda. Waltzing Matilda, go a waltzing Matilda with me.
Well, that was the Pogues with the World War I anti-war song, and the band played Waltzing Matilda. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Concluding our program today from the Old Mole Archive, we revisit Veterans Day 2014 with Fran Michelle and Jan Hawken talking about the strengths and challenges faced by the Veterans Administration healthcare system. This discussion is followed by Denise Morris talking with Jan Hawken about her 2014 documentary film, Mind Zone, Therapist Behind the Front Lines.
Jan, you carried out research at the VA in your recent film project on mental health practices in the military. What did you find out in doing your research?
Well, the VA clinics and healthcare centers, which includes hospitals and a range of clinics and nursing homes, cemeteries, I mean, it's quite an expansive system intended to provide an array of service for those who served in the military. I mean, it's no socialist paradise, but nor is it the hell that critics claim. And if there is a hell, it's often the hell brought to the staff there and these centers by the stories and wounds, some visible, some not, of veterans. One of the social workers I interviewed at the Portland VA Center described the sadness that staff often carry as they care for veterans, as well as the outrage at times over the wars that got them there. She referred to a plaque displayed on the large atrium wall that you see when you enter the VA up center up on the hill, and it says something like, "What you see here is the price of freedom." She said what that plaque should really say is, "What you see here is the price of war." Indeed, entering a VA hospital, sitting in the waiting area, provides a kind of palpable window into the long-term consequences of military service and the chronic conditions of many veterans who generally get very good care. In a 2012 book called Best Care Anywhere, Philip Longman tells the story of the turnaround of the Department of Veterans Affairs healthcare system from a pretty dysfunctional bureaucracy in the 90s into what he claims is a benchmark for high-quality medicine overall in the United States. And the book, which suggests that it should be an example for the single-payer system as a whole, is supported by considerable research comparing the VA system to other healthcare organizations in the U.S., organizations from the RAND Corporation to various national health studies, claim that overall, veterans have more efficient, effective care than comparable systems in the private sector, and the care is done more cheaply in a way that specifically addresses their need. Most veterans associations, including the American Legion, oppose a voucher system and privatizing the VA, and are overall quite happy with the VA system in spite of the enormity of its tasks and its ongoing problems.
So its problems, for instance, its wait times are not really that much worse than privately run hospitals, or is there a difference because of the nature of the population that they're serving, or how does it compare to private hospitals?
Given the enormity of the demands on the VA, which not only include healthcare services, both acute and chronic, but also managing an enormous and in many ways unwieldy benefit system, you know, there's been this enormous outcry about the 2-month waiting lists of veterans at some of the VA clinics. And yet, in one comparable study, people in Los Angeles waited an average of 59 days. In Boston, they waited an average of 63 days. In Washington, D.C., it was 30 days.
And that's in private hospitals rather than VA hospitals in those cities.
Yeah, and VA hospitals have enormous tasks. There also are places where veterans act out a lot of their anger. Some of the staff talked about, you know, violence of veterans who come in, many still armed, are used to being armed, which becomes kind of a psychological kind of form of armor after they leave service, and sometimes displace their anger toward the military that often dumps them at the end of their service. There's a tremendous focus on group solidarity, camaraderie, we're all in a family. When your service is over, that's it. So unless you're in the active component, which is professional military, and if you are in the Guard or the Reserve units, which are a large part of the military veteran population, you kind of get dumped. And they have been working on that transition from the Department of Defense to the VA. So what a lot of staff get is the rage and sadness, as well as trauma, which of course gets talked about a lot, but not so much how the distress of war produces rage and veterans getting very angry and upset. And it's harder to direct that towards the remote military, the Department of Defense, than those staff members, the nurses and clinic staff at your local VA, which is not to say there are not problems there, but it's kind of overdetermined by military experience and war in general.
And is it shaped at all by questions of funding cuts? Has the VA been, you know, is this a case of starving the beast? Is there a problem with understaffing or lack of resources to provide the services that veterans need?
Yeah, and it's much like the public schools in areas where problems are chronic. And in the VA, a lot of problems are chronic. Staff told me that one of the main healthcare ongoing complaints is back pain, as well as chronic mental health problems. But there are other ongoing, you know, people served during World War II are still accessing VA services and often applying for disability benefits. So the nature of chronic problems that are not so easily resolved as they are in affluent communities where there's an acute medical situation and then it's resolved and people have an underlying state of health. So there's that issue. There's also a confound here in that the VA was among the first of the healthcare systems to track their waiting lists and access to care. So data is often a product of the data you gathered. And they've been quite forward-looking in really monitoring many aspects of veterans' needs and care. So there's also that issue that it's always a little compared to what? And we don't have good comparative data, particularly on, perhaps a good comparator would be county clinics in underserved areas around the country who face similar problems and populations.
So the VA is a system that is, in addition to having some gaps between the different systems of healthcare in the country moving from the Department of Defense to the VA, there are also problems with the nature of the population and the lack of resources.
And the lack of a single payer healthcare system in this country. The most common access to VA for people who are not in the active component is through a disability benefit, which ranges from 10 to 100%. A low-level disability will allow you access to health care in the VA. So I think it's an interesting question what level of disability we would have associated with war if we had a fully funded single-payer health care system in this country. Thank you.
are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. From the archive, we continue our Veterans Day programming with a discussion of the documentary film Mind Zone, Therapists Behind the Front Lines. Mind Zone, directed by Jan Hocken, follows the military psychologists who work with the U.S. infantry in Afghanistan to help these soldiers get back into the fight. This segment originally aired in 2017.
Jan, you actually began working on this film in 2009, and that was following the Fort Hood incident where Major Hassan killed 13 soldiers on a military base. But essentially, your interest was more the everydayness of these stresses and the psychological impacts, and also the handling through psychology and therapy of soldiers in combat.
Yeah, and this case was interesting at the time. I was interested in the competing psychological narratives about troubled soldiers, but also getting away from some of the narratives that came out of the Vietnam War of the soldiers coming back as walking time bombs, the psycho vet killer, or the tragic vet who has just completely fallen apart, and just kind of the everyday mental health issues in the military. The military had been doing a lot around all these repeated deployments. During that time, mental health in war zones was part of military planning and had become very extensive. They had gone through a big campaign in the Army to destigmatize seeing mental health practitioners. And that was one reason the Army let me do this project, which was a first for them, was they were very proud of all of this mental health service, including in war zones. And I became interested, well, is this progressive, what they called the new army, the kinder, gentler, more nurturant army? Is this an indication of progress, or is this obscuring other and deeper ethical problems of therapists in war zones who are still serving the mission, which was getting those soldiers back online?
One of the quotes that just resonates from one of the main subjects in your film,
Colonel Rabb,
he describes it like a gun. You have to break it down, provide maintenance to the soldiers psychologically when there is a jam. The job is really to help soldiers clear their minds. The analogy with the gun is state of mind for the process of providing restorative therapy.
And of course, machine metaphors have a long history in psychology. Particularly psychologies that seem more mechanistic. But, you know, we all use metaphors that we draw from the world around us to describe more elusive processes. But I think you're also picking up on a deeper issue in terms of how the mental health practices were very much in the service of keeping the machinery of the military operating. And it was interesting to me to see how this ethical conflicts around that have been talked about since Freud. And that was another pitching point with the Army. Like, there's a military literature over a century on, can you ethically do this? Can you ethically respond to individual suffering and still serve the machinery of war, which is to get people back, because it's very expensive to get those service members out there. And their main job is to just keep them going, keep them in the fight, maintaining the fighting forces. And that's been true for at least a century. Psychologists have been involved in that. And my appeal to the Army was, well, the public has a right to know. And this conversation, that's a very open discussion about the ethics of that in military literature. Ken Burns' recent series on Vietnam War. One problem with that series is it did not focus enough on, or at all really, on the operational side of warfare, even though it did emphasize resistance and conflict within the troops during the Vietnam War, which I think is really important to note. PTSD now is often framed as a reaction to a discrete confrontation with the threat of violence. But often the distress reactions are much more elusive and tied to sources of conflict about the war itself, often, or the mission itself. Most of the previous documentaries focus almost exclusively on the infantry, on the fighters. And yet about 80% of the service members in the Vietnam War and in these recent wars are operational. They're there to support the infantry, the fighting force, and keep those fighters going. And it's phenomenal just seeing the massive number of people that are there to support a relatively small number of actual fighters. And I was interested in those people. That's why the behind the lines has that meaning as well.
The process of getting the soldiers back into the fight is very quick. And they mention a three-day reprieve. 3 days?
And that's as that's as old as World War One. It was called Forward Psychiatry. It's basically three hots in a cot.
Yeah.
But it's kind of dressed up with some other techniques now. But the idea is to allow a kind of temporary regression, they used to call it, into kind of the maternal fold of mental health and then get them back into daddy's war. But the critique of that also, I think, overlooks how limited psychology is, including in dealing with the aftermath of war. And I wanted to emphasize that point. I think overall mental health services have been oversold as an antidote to the impacts of war, either immediate or long term.
One of your psychologists says the crashes have consequences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a very, very long half-life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it also is meant to apply to other places where we use psychology to try to keep people healthy in very unhealthy places.
Right. Well, thank you, Jan. Jan Hocken, director of the film Mind Zone, therapist behind the front lines, which is available now for streaming on Amazon and iTunes.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more a-dying, but I ain't a-marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a-marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't a-marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't a-marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't a-marching anymore. No, I ain't a-marching anymore.
And that concludes our program today. We went out listening to Phil Oakes, I Ain't Marching Anymore. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Thank you to all today's participants, Bill Resnick and Garrett Reppenhagen, Fran Michelle, Denise Morris, and Jan Hocken for their discussion of Veterans Affairs, and to Larry Bolden for his book review. And remember, today, not tomorrow, Garrett Reppenhagen will be speaking at an Armistice Day rally at 11 a.m. at Directors Park at 815 Southwest Park Avenue, sponsored by the Portland Veterans for Peace. His talk is called To Proclaim an End to All Wars. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles will seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives, that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well, can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the Bowles perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the OMO mission. This is KBOO Portland. As always, you will be able to find the podcast of this show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mo Variety Hour on Facebook and follow us at Old Mo on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us at our KBOO webpage or at Old Mo Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. Now, coming up on KBOO at 10 is Locus Focus, where host Barbara Bernstein talks with writer Stephen Hawley and director Michael Peterson, whose new film, Damned to Extinction, looks at the solution to saving both the okras and the salmon. At 11, it's First Voices Radio, where Roberto Rodriguez, where he talks about his new memoir, A Warrior Summoned from the Spirit World.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind disks, I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe.